I'll start at the beginning. Hello, I'm Aaron Ambachi from Sydney. Welcome to season two of the Mojo Record Club.
Hello, I'm Andrew Mayle, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. My guests today are Mojo editor John Mulvey and the Sydney-born experimental guitarist, percussionist, multi-instrumentalist, and label owner, Aaron Ambachi. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Now, Aaron Ambachi has been making music since, I think, the mid-80s. Everything from hypnotic, ambient guitar albums to improv jazz to drone metal to noise to propulsive motoric psych. He has collaborated with many of the greats of experimental music. Mertzbau, Stephen O'Malley, KG Hino, Keith Rowe, Mats Gustafsson, and of course, former Mojo Record Club podcast guest, Jim O'Rourke. He has also made one of my dog's favorite records, 2004's gorgeous Grapes from the Estate. I think it's something about the frequency of the guitar sort of tones on it that she loves particularly.
That's nice to hear.
But in addition to all that, Aaron runs the amazing Black Truffle label, who release records by such contemporary experimental artists as Julia Reedy, Sarah Hennies, and Aiko Ishibashi, but also rare, lost, and unheralded records by the likes of AMM, Annie Lockwood, and Arnold Dreiblatt. In 2002, he made one of Mojo's albums of the year with Ghosted, a live in-the-room collaboration with Johan Bertling and Andreas Werlin of the Swedish experimental free jazz noise trio Fire. Now that trio are back with a sequel, Ghosted 2, which is, I hope he doesn't mind the comparison, which is sort of their Layla Part 2 to Ghosted's Layla. But before we speak to Aaron, let's hear an excerpt from Ghosted 2. This is the album's beautiful third track, Trey. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. My first question is, what was it like following up Ghosted? Did you feel any pressure to, quote unquote, repeat the success? I mean, you've called it Ghosted 2, so you've dived straight into the fact that it is a sequel in a way. But, you know, did you give yourself a brief in terms of how you would follow up? I mean, what was the approach?
I think the approach was exactly the same as the first record, where we just literally got, you know, set up in a room and played together without any discussion about what we were going to do. I think I had playing, I think I had some, yeah, I felt a little bit of pressure, like not to repeat myself, not to repeat what I did on the first record, but I think it was just sort of psyching myself out. As soon as I started playing with those guys, it just sort of flows, and we just have this, yeah, really relaxed kind of communication, and new things always evolve. I really love working with those two. I can kind of do my thing, and they sort of frame it in a particular way. So it was really relaxed, actually, to make the second record.
And when you last spoke to Mojo, you said that you love to hear the influence that different acoustic spaces have on your recordings. So I guess, would you say that the room that you play in Ghosted and the room that the record is recorded in, would you regard that as much a part of the group as yourself, Johan, and Andreas, as this, it's integral to what you're doing?
Absolutely. That particular space is a small studio in the suburbs of Stockholm, and it's kind of like you're playing in someone's lounge room. It has that feeling, and yeah, it's just very easygoing, and the sound is good. You know, like I'm totally influenced by the sound and I'm working with sound. So if it's not inspiring, if I'm sort of struggling, it's very hard for things to flow, but it's quite the opposite at this, in this space. Yeah.
One of the records, I mean, I feel like you put out a lot of music, so there's always the sense that I'm discovering stuff and kind of coming late to albums. At the end of 2023, you released a really gorgeous record with the guitarist and percussionist Robbie Avename and Chris Abrams of The Necks. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that this was your first record with a member of that. I know your paths have crossed repeatedly down the years, but am I right in thinking this is the first recording that you've done with a member of The Necks?
Well, Chris Abrahams plays piano on Shebang, my last solo record.
Yeah.
And I've known him since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Like, I used to see The Necks play before they had a record out in Sydney. So we've known each other for years and we've played on and off for years as well. But it's the first time we, made a record together as a trio.
Yes.
And Robbie, I grew up with. He's a very, very old friend from when I was really young. Yeah. So we've worked together a lot, but we've just never documented it as a record.
Would you say, would you consider them an influence, especially on your later percussive rhythm-led work? Would you sort of regard them as a band or a collective who have influenced you?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, maybe they were just part of the fabric of Sydney sort of underground music scene, improvised music scene. And I've worked a lot with Tony as well, the drummer.
Yeah.
Maybe subconsciously, but I'm originally a drummer myself.
Yes.
So there is, I'm always interested in rhythm and I'm interested in things unfolding over a long period of time. And I find that framing it with rhythm, which I really love anyway, I love rhythmic music, somehow allows me to, I like just juxtaposing sort of abstract textures with repetition and rhythm. Yeah, I like those two things combined. And I guess they do that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the records that you released on Black Truffle, I think in 2021, was Viewfinder/Hide and Seek by the American composer and computer music pioneer David Berman. And
yes,
you've brought in another album by him as your choice for today, which is a record called Leap Day Night, which was originally released on the Lovely Music label back in 1987.
That's
now,
right.
Before we talk about it and Berman himself, let's hear a little extract from the opening track, Leap Day Night Scene 1, written by David Berman and released on the Lovely Music label back in 1987. I suppose my first question, Oren, is when did you first discover the music of David Berman?
His actual solo music, I would have discovered it in the early 90s. I worked in a record store and I was always interested in, discovering things. And we had a lot of lovely music titles that would come in and they always looked really mysterious and alluring. And then I sort of connected the dots. I had, the Columbia, there's a series of records in the late 60s, early 70s on Columbia called The Music of Our Time series. And Berman was the producer of those records and the super influential records, Terry Riley's In C, Rainbow and Curved Air, also by Terry Riley. There was the Extended Voices record, some Stockhausen and Caro, things like that, and widely distributed major label. So I had a lot of those records, and I'm sure a lot of people had those records without realizing that David Berman was connected to it. And I was really interested in Alvin Lucier. And David Berman was a member of the Sonic Arts Union. So that was a collective of four composers, kind of mid-60s to late-60s, David Berman, Alvin Lucier, Robert Ashley, and Gordon Mummer. So I started discovering all of those guys around the same time. And I loved all of their work. Lucier was hugely influential. But when I heard, this record, it was very, very different and very kind of beautiful and very simple in a way. And it was very different to a lot of, I mean, Lucier is kind of elegant as well. But this was overtly melodic, and something about it really appealed to me. It was almost poppy in a way.
And a little bit of background on it. It was recorded with, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's recorded with Rhys Chatham and Ben Neal on trumpet and something called Mutant Trumpet as well. Yeah. And Fluxus mainstay Takehisa Kosugi on violin, and David and Berman himself's on electronics. But electronics really isn't sufficient a word to sort of conjure up what he's doing and kind of his system of making music. So could you maybe explain kind of what his kind of system of computer music was?
Yeah, I'm really, really not an expert in this stuff, but it was this sort of interactive system that he built with really, really early computer systems, self-made electronics, self-made synthesizers, and some conventional synthesizers all combined into this system where the system would sort of respond to the input of an acoustic player. It might respond melodically. I think he called it, he would sort of set up a situation that the player could interact with. So the player would be sort of improvising and responding to the system, and the system would respond to the player. And it was like this cycle that would happen. You can kind of listen to it as this, you know, in some ways it's super ahead of its time, as a technological sort of complex electronic setup that someone sort of made on their own, which is super fascinating. But that's kind of happening, but in a way it's just beautiful music to me, and that's what really appeals to me about it. His electronics are absolutely gorgeous, and hearing an acoustic instrument interact with the electronics is something that I really love, and it really, really appealed to me. And just, the juxtaposition of something acoustic and something electronic is something I really love and really has been really inspiring for me.
But also the way that the electronics respond feels like in a very organic and spontaneous way. A lot of this kind of juxtaposition is normally quite rigorously composed and structured electronic music with freer playing over the top. But this seems to meet in the middle, which is...
This is kind of the opposite. There's kind of this sort of hidden complexity if you look into it, but it's super beautiful. It's kind of very elegant and simple in a way, and the electronics are just really appealing to me, and to many people, I think. And all the playing, you know, he's not really hitting you over the head with the idea. It's a lot of records that really appeal to me are records that it's kind of like, this is the idea of the record. You put the needle down and you just go with this idea that these people explore over a long period of time. And it's kind of gorgeous, you know, it's not intellectual in a way.
It made me think, and I don't know if this is necessarily correct, but it made me think, it reminded me of, it's very much a jazz album to me, you know, kind of in the sense that you've got, it's almost like a jazz trio and you've got kind of, you know, trumpet and violin, but then you've got this musician who is kind of responding to what, you know, those other two instruments are playing and everything. So, and at times it sounds like jazz as well. It has that quality, doesn't it? Sonically.
Absolutely. Yeah. It could be on ECM. Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, maybe. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, so yeah, 70s ECM, they would have allowed it, you know?
Yeah, I think so. Just a bit more reverb, but yeah, it could have made the grade.
It's texturally, it's also like some of those 70s Riley records, more than the Riley records he was involved with. It reminds me of things like Persian Surgery Dervishes and things like that a little bit as well. That rippling, that sort of infinite ripples of the electronics.
For sure. It's definitely got that quality. Yeah. And there's something about the quality of that period, you know, records from that time. I just, yeah, love them. Whether they're song-based pop records or you know, prog records or jazz records. Yeah, there's something about it that really appealed. Yeah, I love
it. Is it that point where you get that crossover with the kind of acoustic, organic, and the electronic and processed? And so you can have kind of, you know, you're hearing kind of live instruments, but you're also hearing electronics.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you're familiar with Kasugi's solo record, Catch Wave. He was in the Taj Mahal Travelers. And so there's something kind of similar. There's a psychedelic thing going on. There's this organic, flowing, long form, you know, this sort of drone underneath and this sort of improvised exploration on top. Yeah, and Riley did that too, for sure.
I totally forgot about that record. I knew I recognised the name from somewhere. I was like, when I was making notes about the Kasugi piece on it, I wrote down at some point, it's like Tony Conrad playing the Lark Ascending kind of thing. It's kind of got that sort of vibe to it. But.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Henry Flint as well. I don't know if you're familiar with his stuff. It's not hillbilly, but it's got that fiddle, you know, simple kind of vibe about it that I really like.
It's very approachable as well. It's one of these records. I'm always quite interested in that point where the uncompromising avant-garde becomes accessible to a broader audience if the audience is open to it. I mean, hopefully some of the listeners to this podcast as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I think there's so much of a cliche around experimental music about it being inevitably forbidding, mm-hmm. which is so far from the truth. And this is such a beautiful and approachable record, I think.
Yeah, I think that's kind of why I chose it. I had so many choices and it was quite, you know, torturous trying to find one thing. And I sort of, yeah, maybe because of the audience, Mojo audience, I sort of wanted to frame something that might be, yeah, like something that no one would even touch, you know, but it's actually really beautiful and super approachable for sure. And I was talking to Verna Durand, who is a sax player who works a lot with Berman. He's on the Black Truffle record of Berman's that I released. And he was telling me that when Kasugi and Berman played that stuff in Berlin in the late 80s, and they played it in a very kind of stiff new music, improvised music context, how it was really, really hated. Like people booed, people left, which I find so bizarre, you know, because they probably found it super cheesy, super easy, you know. And I know a lot of people that in the experimental world that probably 20, 25 years ago would not listen to this record, you know, because of that. And now, there seems to be, it's almost like, yeah, it was ahead of its time in a way. And people are coming to that kind of thing now.
But you're right. There's that sort of presumption that experimental music should be challenging to the listener as it is in a conceptual form, you know, sort of like the idea should be conveyed to the listener in the form of like how complex the process of making it is should be conveyed to the listener in terms of how complex it is to listen to, you know.
Exactly.
And so people respond oddly to experimental music or kind of music with theory behind it that is also a beautiful listening experience.
Yeah, and I love things that don't hit you over the head. Like I don't like being told, you know, where it's spelt out that this is experimental because of XYZ. It's super experimental. There's, you know, this guy's built this system himself that is interacting. It's almost like AI. It's interacting with an acoustic instrument in real time. That's kind of nuts that someone's doing that, you know, in the 80s. But in some ways, who cares? Like, it's beautiful music, and it moves me, and I want to listen to it. So I like that those things, there's this thing that's sort of underneath, but it's not the fundamental point of the music.
Interspecies Small Talk Part 2, taken from the album Leap Day Night, originally released on the Lovely Music label in 1987, written and produced by David Berman. This definitely deserved to be heard. One track was absolutely not enough. An amazing record.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Oren Ambachi.
In many ways, you've kind of defined the philosophy of a lot of the stuff that came out on Lovely Music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of like Robert Ashley or Blue Jean Tyranny or John Hassell.
Yep.
Like stuff that is kind of like you, and I, by you, I mean me, can, you know, before you hear this music, you might be put off by the image of the artist or the name of the artist. And then when you actually listen to it, you find that this music is incredibly beautiful or soothing or kind of hypnotic.
Yeah. And also very quirky. You know, a lot of the Lovely Music releases are really quirky and kind of very personal and very, bizarre in a way. Like, especially Robert Ashley's music, but very, very in its own world. You know, I love that. That label was, so big for me.
When you were talking about the, I've forgotten what it's called now, I'm ashamed to say, the series that of album, the major label series of albums that... Music of Our Time. That I'm always fascinated as well by when major labels try and frame experimental music, and that strikes me as one of those kind of educational series, rather that it was necessarily forbidding and uncompromising because it was kind of good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Which it's almost like this moral imperative, improving imperative that. Amazing to think of now, major labels had to some degree in the 60s.
I mean, it's bizarre, the things that the really cutting, like super edgy, super out there releases that came out on major labels that would just never happen today. You know, the first AMM record was on Elektra. The first MEV record was on Polydor. You know, it just would never happen today. But it's almost like, you know, grunge music like Nirvana came out, so we're going to sign as many noisy bands with flannel as possible. The Beatles are doing psychedelia, so we don't know what it is, so let's just sign all these people that are doing something that's a bit experimental or psychedelic, so to speak.
And the Beatles were going to AMM gigs as well.
Definitely. I mean, I love all that stuff, that sort of crossover. I'm a huge McCartney fan, and I always talk about McCartney going to AMM shows and or Sid Barrett sort of emulating Keith Rowe's guitar playing and things like that. Really, I love all that stuff. Jim O'Rourke told me a great story when he was playing in Sonic Youth, and there was this festival that they played at, and it was that Neil Young sort of festival where they raised money, and I think it was McCartney, Tony Bennett, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Sonic Youth, and Neil Young, maybe another group. But Jim's also a huge McCartney fan, and he went backstage and was talking to McCartney and started to talk to him about AMM. And McCartney was sort of like, I don't know, AMM, who's that? You know, and Jim was sort of describing who they were, and then McCartney goes, Coors Band, yeah, they were great. In other words, Cornelius Cardew's band.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that the time that Jim started interrogating him and Thurston started interrogating McCartney about his brother's record?
Yes.
Yeah, the McGough McGear album. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, the McGear, the Mike McGear solo record.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a great record. And then McCartney called his brother on the phone. It's like, these guys love your record. You should speak to them.
Yeah, that ends up in Thurston's book. That's
all right.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I knew I'd heard it somewhere.
One of the things I wanted to ask about David Berman is, I mean, he's building his own homemade synthesizers long before Robert Moog. He studies with Stockhausen alongside Lamont Young. He's works with John Cage, Merce Cunningham, as you say, co-founds the Sonic Arts Union with Robert Ashley, Alvin Lucia, produces Terry Riley's Intensity. And yet all those names, to my mind, are better known in the music circles that I move in than David's name is.
Yeah.
It's like, it seems to me, and I just kind of wonder what you think is the reason why he still seems to be. If the radar is Lamonty Young, then he's under that radar, and why you think that is, given his achievements and given how wonderful his music is.
Well, Lamont Young and David Berman are two completely different personalities. One is a kind of a megalomaniac. And
which one, Lauren?
And David Berman is a super modest, sweet, quiet guy. I mean, it's kind of like his music. It's absolutely beautiful. And he's a really, really lovely person and not a pushy guy. And a lot of his, you know, he ended up doing a lot of music for Merce Cunningham for many, many years. And I think he really got caught up in that and just wasn't releasing a lot of albums. So maybe more under the radar because of that. Just a very... like not a pushy guy at all, you know. I the first time I met him, I was very tipsy at Phil Niblock's 80th birthday party, and I could see David Berman in the corner, and I mustered up the courage to blather how much I loved his music, and he was just so, really, you know, you really and he's just not a careerist kind of person at all. So maybe that's why.
It's like, I remember there was a reissue, lovely, because I think some of these records were quite hard to get a hold of for a while, weren't they? And
yeah, this one's still, I mean, it was available on CD, but it's not been reissued on vinyl.
Yeah, because there was a vinyl reissue of On Another Ocean about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and I remember and it came out around the same time as there was a reissue of Ashley's Private Parts, which is a record I knew and loved, and but there was this other record that came with it that I'd never heard of, you know, and I thought that, and was equally fantastic.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
And it's kind of slightly a shame that I've never investigated him more until.
Yeah, now, really. Yeah, that's another reason why I chose him. Yeah, it's hopefully more people discover his work.
I think they're bound to, and I think this is something John was asking me, so I suppose in a way I'm hijacking one of John's questions, but I hope he doesn't mind. You seem quite kindred spirits in terms of like the music you make. There's a kind of, there's that sort of meditative sort of busyness. There's the constant motion. But also that sense of serenity as well that the music is seeking. Would you cite him as an influence?
Absolutely. I would, totally ripping him off. I love his music. It's funny. I a lot of my multi-track sessions, there are tracks that just say Berman, referring to a guitar part or something, because it's just me trying to cheaply imitate what he does with the gear that I have. He's a huge influence, and I'm constantly trying to kind of do that on the guitar in a way, with whatever tools I have. And it's funny, and then when I've worked with Jim O'Rourke, also, I've gone to his place and looked at his multi-tracks, and it says Berman, Berman 2, Berman 3. we both do that because we're just, he's just really singular and very inspiring, his sounds. In fact, like, I think the first time I ever recorded a duo with Jim, I was incredibly hungover from karaoke the night before, and I just said, I can't come over. I'm too exhausted. And he's like, come on. So I went over, and he he handed me Kim Gordon's guitar, and he's like, just play. And he's just started recording, and I was like so freaked out. I was like, dude, I don't want to play guitar in front of you. Come on. And he had these panels of synths, and I said, look, I'll play, but can you make my guitar sound like Leap Day Night? And within 5 minutes, he just did all this crazy patching.
Wow.
And I plugged my guitar into his huge Surge synths, and all of a sudden it sounded like Leap Day Night, and he was sort of fist pumping as I played.
Oh, that's so brilliant.
Yeah, Berman's just, yeah, huge for us.
I don't want to completely derail this excellent conversation, but I have to ask what you sing at karaoke, Oren.
Oh, man, so much. Everything. Yeah.
Were you at karaoke with Jim and Iko?
I've done karaoke with Jim a number of times, probably, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 times, like loads of times. I've done karaoke with all kinds of people. Yeah.
names. Come on.
Oh. Well, this is a weird one. KG Hino.
Oh.
We did some Beatles together, actually, as a duo.
I think what did you do?
He did a lot of really, he really would not want me to say this, but anyway, it's too late now. He did a lot of really early Beatles stuff.
Yeah.
On his own. I think we did Don't Let Me Down, but oh. I don't remember. Yeah.
Not Revolution 9. That'd be a good karaoke.
It's kind of bizarre because I've done it, and I'll be singing a Billy Joel song or something, and Tony Conrad's sort of sitting next to me, or, you know, someone like that. A bizarre one was doing it with CC Hennix and Tony Conrad because CC Hennix started singing all these Velvet Underground songs. And I kind of was like, this is really weird. Like, she's singing Velvet Underground and Tony Conrad's over there, and it's just, yeah, kind of bizarre.
Because one of my questions was going to be, you know, kind of, what is it like? You've had the chance to meet so many of your heroes, these legends of 20th century music. And I guess kind of, and maybe you've answered it, that how you deal with it is by going to karaoke with them.
I think, you know, when I was younger, you know, I absolutely admire all these people, and they're hugely influential and pioneers of this music. But, you know, they're also just artists, and they also question themselves, and they're also trying to, you know, do something new every time they make something. So they're just people in the end, and super influential and inspiring people. The great thing about a lot of these artists is when they talk to you, they just talk to you like you're a peer, you know, but they're still absolute legends for sure.
When you were saying that Leap Day Night has a kind of a sonic texture and a feel that you like across a bunch of other records and genres from that sort of late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s period, what other records from sort of different worlds would you file alongside it for that kind of feel?
Oh, for that kind of feel, I don't know. But, I mean, we could be here for hours, you know, talking about records.
Excellent.
Because, yeah, I mean, God, like just listening to a Genesis record like Gabriel Era or 10cc or, you know, the Leslie guitar sound on the first Joe Walsh record, all these things are huge for me. You know, I just love the quality of those records and the way they were recorded. And there's so much, you know, this doesn't make them great, but there's so much experimentation. There's so much detail in the way these records were made with very limited means and, you know, limited technology. So that's the stuff that really fires me up. Yeah, all the McCartney records. I could just go on.
Were any of those records on your kind of initial list of, like, that you were going to pick?
Yeah, yeah. I had 10cc down. I had
which one?
Well, that's really hard. That's enough. The first four, of course, but yeah, I don't know which one I would have chosen.
Because also there's the Godly and Cream albums as well, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes. You know, the first disc of Consequences is absolutely incredible, insane. That record's insane. And Freeze Frame is incredible as well for Godly and Cream. Yeah, but then I had people, you know, like there's a Uruguayan guy I really love called Eduardo Mateo. I don't know if you've heard his stuff from the 70s. I was going to choose him, but then I was a little self-conscious that I don't know enough about that scene to really speak about it. But I really love his 70s records. The last few years, I've been pretty obsessed with his work. Yeah.
I hope that the people listening were writing all that down and they're going to go out and investigate all that stuff.
We'll have to make extra long show notes.
And yes. No, there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. Yeah. Oren, I've asked all my questions. Thank you so much for taking the time out. And thank you for bringing such a brilliant record, a record I'd not heard before. And I'm just delighted to have discovered it via you. So that's fantastic.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Just by the way, I love Mojo magazine. Just saying.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's all the stuff that I really dig. Yeah. So really nice to do this.
Excellent. No, thank you. We might leave that in.
Get that bit soon.
No. Cool.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks a lot.
You too. Bye-bye. I'm Oren Mbachi, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club.
Okay, now we get to the part of the show where we talk about our favorite current releases. My pick for this month is Cold Sea, the first solo album by Oisin Leach. Leach is from County Meath, and prior to this album, he'd worked as a playwright, and he was in a folk harmony duo called The Lost Brothers. And this album was recorded with Mojo favorite Steve Gunn as producer. And they recorded it in an old sea-facing Donegal schoolhouse. And it features an amazing lineup of musicians, including, as mentioned, Steve Gunn, M. Ward, Donald Lunny, and Tony Garnier. And apparently it's an album inspired by Bruce Chatwin's songlines and the poems of Seamus Heaney, which perhaps explains why Leach's songs have this kind of haunting, enigmatic, unresolved quality that Steve Gunn, who's a brilliant producer, has enhanced by the use of reverb and subtle synthesizer drones. Also, the schoolhouse is wood paneled, and they borrowed a vintage U87 mic off one of Oisin's neighbors. So it has this kind of very kind of warm, yet echoey, yet eerie quality, which is unique, I think, integral to the strange, unresolved quality of his songs. Anyway, I've chosen a track where you can clearly hear Dylan bassist Tony Garnier's upright bass. This is The Color of the Rain, written by Oisin Leach and released on Outsider Music.
Feels like we're moving through the reeling rain. Feels like we're moving through the healing days.
I was going to say something about how mysterious and powerful this record is and how it seems to be in some ways greater than the sum of its parts. But I think you kind of spoiled that, Andrew, really, because you've explained, you've quite forensically why it sounds as good and as interesting as it does. Because,
but I don't think I fully got to the heart of it. That, I mean, if that's what I did, then I apologize, because there is something still that is unresolved in the song and unresolved in the sounds. There's a sense in which kind of there's a mystery and a poetry to them.
And which transcends what it initially sounds like, which is quite a conventional, if understated, singer-songwriter album. It's like, I think, I have to say, I didn't think I needed a new album so obviously redolent of Nick Drake, for instance. And bits of this record sound really like Nick Drake, but not in that slightly facile, how can I put it, soft, overly soft way that a lot... I think a lot of people who are inspired by Nick Drake often tend towards what they perceive as Nick Drake's politeness and the neatness of Nick Drake's music. And while this record isn't a kind of black-eyed dog record either, it's not a record that zeroes relentless in on the agonies at the heart of Drake's music. It just gets... It gets that kind of that woody warmth really, really well, I think.
But not in a way that feels utterly cozy. It's kind of there's something kind of there's a chill there as well. And I think kind of there's something, I think the thing I was saying about it feeling unresolved, there's something about his use of melody, or maybe what I mean is kind of his reluctance to fully engage with melody. So there's always a sense in which kind of the melodic lines aren't completely resolved. There's he avoids a kind of certain neatness, and he leaves kind of songs with a kind of open feeling. And that's obviously what Steve Gunn hears, because he kind of adds this kind of distance and kind of ghostly kind of quality to it. So you really feel that there is like almost like there's another presence in the room, you know, that they have this, there's something very eerie about the songs and the way they're produced. And like you, I kind of, it's not normally my genre. It's not normally a world that I'm drawn to, but they do something, they add something else to it, which I'm really, and I don't know what that extra thing is, I guess is what we're both saying. They add this extra unknown element.
Yeah. And also like the amazing mystique of having Tony Garnier on day release from the Dylan Band, which is
incredible.
Not something that I think happens a huge
and event, his sound, certainly. He sounds fantastic on it. That upright bass sound is like really adds this kind of like lovely kind of spooky warmth to the record as well.
Yeah, that's it. It's cold warmth.
Yes, absolutely. Perfectly put. Okay, John, what's your record of the month?
It's quite a bigger record
in
sound and personnel than Ashin's record, I think. The album I brought along to the club today is Gratitude by Cassie Kinoshi's Seed. That's Seed with a small S and a full stop after it. And sometimes actually it has ensemble after it as well. So I'm not sure whether this is a Seed ensemble record or a Seed record. Anyway, you might have heard Kinoshi and Seed ensemble a few years ago in 2019 when her first album, Driftglass, got nominated as what we used to call the token jazz album in the UK's Mercury Prize Awards before jazz was a bit more of a thing again, fortunately, and more jazz records started getting in there. Since then, she's kept a slightly lower profile than some of her more famous contemporaries like Shabaka Hutchins, whose new solo record, by the way, is fantastic, and I hope we get to talk about that in the next few weeks. And Nubaya Garcia. And Kinoshi's been playing in a couple of bands, Nerija and Kokoroko. But she's a massive talent, and it feels like it comes to fruition here, not just as a saxophonist, but as a composer and arranger of something that perhaps, even though a lot of these new British jazz musicians started as part of a big band, Tomorrow's Warriors, they actually don't often carry that big band aesthetic and dynamic that much into their more mature music, I think. But that's what Gratitude is, really. It's a half-hour symphonic piece with an orchestra. There's also a turntablist working discreetly in there as well. But really, it's a beautifully old-fashioned way of musically articulating a kind of contemporary London experience in a way that perhaps someone as rich and innovative as Gil Evans maybe would approach music. I suppose one word that I keep coming back to about this record is that it kind of swings in a way that maybe seems a little old hat for the edgier end of jazz, but is when it's done well, it's absolutely exhilarating, and I find that that's kind of what happens here.
All right, let's hear a bit of Gratitude by Cassie Kinoshi-Seed. This is track 2 from the album, written by Cassie Edenike Kinoshi and released on the International Anthem label. I'm a bit more mixed on this one than you, John, possibly because it's that crossover space between big band and fusion, which I'm not a huge fan of, unless I suppose the force is used for evil. This is maybe all a little bit too nice for me. At times I felt like I was sitting in the lobby of a trendy London boutique hotel. I mean, can you mention Gil Evans? One of my favorite big band albums is Into the Heart by Gil Evans. But that's built around the Cecil Taylor unit. And I feel like this needed a bit of a wild card like that in there to hook me in. And I'm not saying that it's not an album. I listen to it and I can totally appreciate the art of it and the expression of it. It's just that sonically, it's in a place where it's just a little bit too... As you say, it kind of swings in a nice way, and I kind of want a little bit more grit in the oyster, maybe. Yeah, a little bit more gnarled, yeah.
No. I mean, it's like I love those earlier Gil Evans records, like Individualism, the Individualism especially.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, and I do find some kind of modern takes on a slightly older and more classical school of jazz to be a little bit polite. There are some records that come fanfaring themselves as spiritual jazz, which do sound quite Bright and Weinbar kind of thing to me a little bit.
Yeah.
Although I have to say there's this record from last year that I belatedly stumbled upon. By a New Zealand jazz band called The Circling Sun.
Oh,
that I've been playing to death, actually. And it is kind of one of those records. It's like quite a sort of nice, jolly, cleaned up version of hairy spiritual jazz, I suppose. But it's just a really it's kind of sometimes. We've got a short interview with Cassie Kinoshi in a forthcoming issue of Mojo, and I was reading it this morning, and she's talking about how one of the liberating and democratizing byproducts of this sort of UK jazz renaissance, for want of a better term, is that it's a democratizing and community-oriented movement rather than an elitist one, and that it's one which promotes dancing and togetherness, and it's kind of jazz as a positive force rather than jazz as a spiritual force, or jazz as a willfully it comes back to some of the things we were talking about with Oren in different genres, that sometimes music uses its own forbiddingness to assert its bona fides.
Yeah.
And sometimes I really like that. And, you know, God knows I really like a lot of quite gnarly and difficult music, not least with jazz. But sometimes something which is beautifully through composed and balanced and delicately but innovatively arranged, so that you get those dimensions of the orchestra with the sort of 10-piece seed ensemble going, and everyone gets a bit of a go in the spotlight. You know, Shirley Teto, who plays guitar on this record, is absolutely
fantastic,
superb, I think. And she, although I don't think she brings quite the level of grit or that kind of texture that you're quite that you're alluding to, but her guitar tone is a bit more abrasive than some of the other things on there. But it's just it passes in a very sort of energizing blur, I think, as a record.
And I think you're right that it's indicative of where British jazz is at the moment. You know, there's a sense of the remit, the genre is much wider, and it's much more embracing of different sounds and kind of tastes. And it's it's inevitable then that you're going to find areas that are some people are going to like more than others. And it's like, you can't deny the craft of it and you can't deny the skill of it.
It has compositional rigor rather than sort of untethered free improvisation or sort of, it doesn't have that sense of that some jazz has of no one playing it, let alone people listening to it, quite knowing where the music is going to go next.
And
they know very well where they're going next, but in this case, it doesn't sort of lessen my enjoyment of it.
And going back to what Oren was saying earlier about him liking music where there is a structure, but the structure gives you freedom on top, to just go a bit wilder. And maybe I just missed a little bit of that wildness.
Sure. Okay. I get that.
Brilliant. Okay. You've been listening to Oren Ambarchi, John Mulvey, and myself, Andrew Mayle. That was the Mojo Record Club, and we hope to see you at the next one. You can all join in. And look in the episode description for full details of all the tracks we played. And don't forget to like and subscribe. It's hugely appreciated.
You've been listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Oren Ambarchi. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening.
Now, while it's still warm, let us pour in all the mystery.